A core part of our identity as a church for the past 22 or 23 years has been our commitment to being an open and affirming congregation. And historically, this has been closely associated with our unconditional embrace and welcome of LGBT persons. But being an open and affirming congregation can also have a broader meaning to that. It can relate to however we receive someone who walks through the front doors of our church. Do we receive them as a child of God? Do we receive them in the same way that we would like to be received ourselves? Now, as the pastor here, I think it's my job to occasionally challenge us, myself included, to see if we can stretch out our arms even wider as we welcome and embrace people that walk through our front door. So in order to challenge us this morning, what I want to invite you to do is to imagine that feelings and emotions are people, and that in through our front door walks none other than anger himself, or herself as the case may be. Now, tell me honestly, how many of you would really rather not let anger through our front door? I certainly don't feel good when people direct anger at me, and even if they're not directing at me, it makes me feel pretty unpleasant, uncomfortable. So we may want to consider, you know, that our open affirming policy, it doesn't apply to maybe certain things like anger, right? We may want to think about that and just bar anger, because really, shouldn't churches be a no-fly zone for anger? That would seem to make sense. But before we get carried away with that idea, I'm reminded of a children's book I've been reading to my daughter lately. And it's a book written by Arun Gandhi, the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. And it's a true story from his own life. When he was 12 years old, he moved from South Africa to India and lived in his grandfather's village. And in his village one day, he was playing soccer with the other boys. And in the midst of playing, one of the boys knocked him to the ground. And Arun was convinced that this boy did it on purpose. And so he jumped up and he grabbed a rock and was about to throw it and hit the other kid with the rock, when all of a sudden he became self-conscious of the other kids viewing him as the grandson of Gandhi. And how could the grandson of Gandhi get so angry that he was going to do violence against someone else? And so he became filled with shame, dropped the rock, and took off running. And with tears streaming down his face, he ran all the way to his grandfather's house, barged in through his attendants and everything, and told them everything that had happened, blurted it all out, how he's feeling and everything. And his grandfather then responded by, in essence, saying that anger is normal and that everyone gets angry. And what Arun has trouble wrapping his mind around and what blows him away is that everyone includes his grandfather, the Mahatma. And he can't believe that even his grandfather gets angry. Now, to bring that back to our context here in the church, right? The tricky thing about anger is that thing that none of us like, but all of us have, right? And if anger is a reality for all of us, then all of us can bring it into this church. And if we're going to bar anger, then we'd have to bar ourselves, and we'd have to bar peaceful saints like Gandhi. And that's not to say that every time any one of us walks through the front door, we're feeling angry. I hope not. Probably wouldn't say something good about our church. But I think the appropriate analogy here is to think of anger as being like hunger, thirst, and pain. It's part of our biological reality as humans that all of us have this capacity for anger. And what would the world be like if we couldn't get angry? Has anyone ever come to you after a horrendous experience, and one of the best things that you could tell that person is that they have a right to be angry? They've been fired unfairly by their boss at work, and you say, you have a right to be angry about that. And we can apply the same sort of thinking to social justice issues. When a group of people have been horrendously wronged, they have a right to be angry. If a group of women have been forcibly sterilized, I've learned that happened 100 years ago in the state of Washington, they have a right to be angry, right? And so people have this right to be angry, and maybe it's a good thing that biologically we've evolved that way. And you've probably heard it said that pain is your body sending you a message. Well, anger is similar in a way, because it's sending us a message, and sometimes that message is that all is not right. And sometimes the additional message is that things need to change. But there's a caveat with anger, and this is something that Gandhi told his grandson after he explained that everyone gets angry sometimes. Then he said, what matters isn't whether or not you're angry, what matters is what you do with your anger. And Gandhi put it this way, there's two ways that we can deal with our anger. One is we can let it strike like lightning and break things up, or we can channel our anger and transform our anger and turn it into a productive source of light for ourselves and for others. Now, what Gandhi was essentially promoting is what we might think of as a third response to anger, a third path for anger. The first path we can think of as being repression. We can repress our anger, and scientific studies have told us that when we repress our anger, our blood pressure, we get high blood pressure, and we all know that leads to serious health problems. So repressing our anger isn't the right answer. The complete opposite of repressing our anger is to just uncork it and let it all fly out, right? And this has actually become a pretty popular view. I mean, from the Greeks to Freud to today, it's been called the catharsis hypothesis, that if we, hit a punching bag, or if we let out a primal scream, it will make us feel better. We just need to let it all fly out. Well, a number of studies have now shown that that's a myth, right? That when we have those discharges of anger, instead of soothing anger, it actually fuels anger. And so maybe that's not the response that we want to give to anger. And so then Gandhi gives us this third response of channeling and transforming our anger. And I think along with this third response, there's also the self-soothing of our anger. I know when I get angry, it helps if I call somebody I trust and I talk about what I'm feeling. Also, if I have a lot of negative energy pent up, it's good if I go for a walk or for a run. Then I'm unleashing that energy, but it's not fueling my anger. It's causing it to dissipate. Now, a lot of us do these things in our everyday life, and we don't probably think of them as anger management strategies. We've just kind of naturally, grown up and evolved in our lives to do these things. But anger can still be a really difficult emotion to deal with. It can be difficult to deal with in churches. Now, when I talk about anger walking through our front door, I'm not talking about anger walking through our front door with guns blazing. Because there's an important point to be made that anger is a feeling, not an action. And when people are angry, there's any number of ways they can act and respond to that anger. Right? It doesn't have to be with guns blazing. And indeed, there are churches that put up signs that say, "No guns allowed." That's addressing a separate issue. But anger, even with those points made, anger can be very difficult for churches to deal with. But what I've come to the conclusion this past week is that open and affirming churches are very, very well suited for dealing with anger. We're built for it almost. And I came to this conclusion when I discovered the works of a psychiatry instructor at Harvard named Joseph Schrand. And he's become well known for directing a center for teenagers who abuse drugs. And I was kind of surprised. I watched a video of him, and as they say, he's no spring chicken. But amazingly, he's been able to work effectively, and he's been able to cross the generation gap and the age gap and work effectively with people much, much younger than him. And as I read his works, I could understand why. Based upon his experience with adult psychiatric cases and with teenagers and just everyday life out in the world, he's written a book called Outsmarting Anger. And in this book, he talks about what doesn't work in addressing anger and what does work. And some of the things that don't work, it doesn't work to dismiss anger, to say something like, temper tantrums won't help you, or it doesn't work to try to change their feelings and say, what you really need to do is calm down. That actually doesn't work. Also, what doesn't work is to let yourself be a doormat, because you're not doing a favor to your own self-worth and dignity. It really doesn't work to tell somebody that they have an anger problem. I don't know if you've ever tried to do that. Right? They just end up getting more angry at you, right? And what really, really doesn't work is to escalate the situation by bringing your own anger into it. So what does work? Well, Schran gives this whole approach, and some of the things that are components of this approach is that it works to engage someone and to disarm their anger with empathy, with respect, with listening. Now, some of those things sound a lot like our scripture reading for today, when James says everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Right. Interestingly, James doesn't say don't be angry. But there's more to Schran's approach to buttress this and to go forth with it. He talks about having a genuine interest in why somebody's angry, what's behind it. He talks about engaging them and bringing a sincere demeanor of peace and calmness. He talks about bringing them a magnanimous offer of friendship, because if you're befriending someone, it's hard for them to be angry at you. He also talks how there can be a well-placed and well-timed appropriate use of humor in addressing anger. And at the core behind all of his thrust is this idea that one communicates to the other person that they're valued. And as I was reading all of this, it struck me, wow, a lot of this resonates with what it means to be an open and affirming church. Valuing everyone, respecting, having empathy, listening, even humor, all these good things for open and affirming churches. And what also struck me is that there's a lot of common sense to Schran's approach. The novelist Louisa May Alcott once said that it takes two flints to make a fire. And in essence, what Schran's approach says is that in engaging someone who's angry, one doesn't want to bring one's own flint to it. We've got control over our own responses to what we do. And then what he's also in essence saying is creating a situation in which the other person can put down their piece of flint. They can say, hey, this person is actually listening to me. They're respecting me. I can put this down at least for a moment. And Schran has a number of real life stories where he puts all of this into action, and they're remarkable stories. And my favorite story is one where he comes home from work one day, and in his front yard there's a man he's never seen before, a complete stranger, and he's nailing a yard sign in his front lawn. And Schran has enough self-awareness to know that he shouldn't enter into the situation holding out a piece of flint. Because sure enough, the other man has a piece of flint. As he's approaching the man, he can tell by the man's body language that he's bristling with anger. And that he's assumed this defensive posture where he's daring someone to challenge him. And so Schran approaches him, and in a gentle, soft voice, he asks the man what he's doing. The man very defensively responds by saying that right next to the fire hydrant, it's land that's public property, and he has a right to nail down this sign. And so Schran could have challenged him and confronted him, but instead what Schran does is he disarms him with humor, and he makes a joke saying, well, I sure hope that it's not the sign of some political candidate I can't stand. And then the man kind of calm down and relax, and they created a space for them to have an actual conversation. And they began talking, and what Schran learned is that this man was nailing down a sign for a yard sale. And then after 3 years of going through the belongings of his late wife, he was finally going to have a yard sale. And as they continued to talk, he learned that one morning this man woke up and he went downstairs to make breakfast, and he was going back up to get his wife and was bringing her coffee in bed, and he walked into their bedroom and found her laying there peaceful but unresponsive and not breathing. As the man was talking about this, his eyes filled with tears. Now, this was a situation that could have easily and quickly escalated, but instead it became a situation in which two strangers forged an incredibly deep bond and connection. Train also tells a number of stories of his work with teenagers, and one of the things he points out with his work with teenagers, often they're these teenagers who are dealing with addiction problems, they're coming in with carrying a lot of anger. And what he says is that these kids have, due to all of their life experiences, they are remarkable empathizers. They understand rejection, neglect, abuse, disrespect, life struggles than most adults. And what they do in this program is that they make these youth feel valued, they make them feel respected, they praise them, and soon they begin to see this shift in patterns of behavior. And soon the youth begin supporting each other in their recovery and in their sobriety. And that support that they give to each other, when they're giving that support, the youth are also restoring themselves. And it becomes a work of restoration for themselves to be able to support others. Now, this may be kind of a radically jarring idea, but what if we thought of this Center for Youth Dealing with Drug Addictions, what if we thought of that as a metaphor for our church, as an open and affirming congregation? What if we thought of our church as this place in which we unconditionally embrace people with anger or no anger, and in unconditionally embracing people, we become a place of restoration? And in unconditionally embracing people, we actually greatly multiply our capacity and our power for empathy and support. Because the thing with values like empathy, listening, respect, is that they're gifts that keep on giving. And so I say, brothers and sisters, let anger walk through our front door and let it be part of what makes this church a sacred and wonderful place. Amen.